الحمد لله، الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا محمد وعلى آله وأصحابه وأمته وبارك وسلم. فقد قال الله سبحانه وتعالى: أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ألم تر إلى الذين خرجوا من ديارهم وهم ألوف حذر الموت، فقال لهم الله: موتوا ثم أحياهم، إن الله لذو فضل على الناس ولكن أكثر الناس لا يشكرون. Allah declares in the Holy Quran, Have you not seen those who fled their homes in their thousands for fear of death from contagion? Whereupon Allah said to them, Die, and then brought them back to life. Surely Allah is bountiful to mankind, but most of humanity are ungrateful. Last week we introduced the subject of the supposedly contradictory hadith related to contagion and epidemics and quarantine in the context of Tibb al-Nabawi, which we will attempt to use as a means to reconcile those hadith, more so in the context of the overarching Islamic laws that guarantee fundamental rights. Islamic Sharia, the sacred law, is the revealed will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and it prevails over the state. It is preceding and is never preceded by any state. It is controlling, it is never controlled by any society. Amongst the immutable rights that we listed last week in the context of this discussion is the right to live in dignity. We also emphasized the right of choice last week. We emphasized the right of freedom of movement, the right to seek a livelihood, and even the right to protest, which are all guaranteed in the Sharia, and these are immutable, non-negotiable rights. Having listed those Shari'i rights last week, we emphasized how it was imperative to understand the ahadith related to contagion and quarantine in a manner that is commensurate with these Quranic principles. And therefore, Tibb al-Nabawi gives us those appropriate tools whereby to correctly interpret those relevant ahadith. The most fundamental principle of Tibb, which we introduced last week, was that of the inherent balance imbued in creation, or khalq, what in English we refer to as physis. Physis is that organizing principle that draws us towards an ideal state of health, or what we call natural balance. Balance being health, imbalance being experienced as ill health. We therefore emphasized last week how no medicine we take can heal the body without the body's internal processes at work directed to achieve that end. And Tibb recognizes the body's own ability to heal, and therefore Tibb works in accordance with this innate ability to heal, not in any way obstructive, as we find in Western allopathic medicine. Another important Tibb principle that will assist us in interpreting the ahadith relevant to contagion and plague and epidemics and quarantine is the concept of mizaj, or temperament. We said that it's more important to know what sort of person has a disease than to know what sort of disease a person has. And a person's temperament has a direct influence on his or her state of health, and also their inclination to varying illnesses. While some may be susceptible to an ailment, we find others are quite immune. Although each person is quite unique when it comes to temperament, we can broadly categorize all human beings into four main temperamental types, which in Tibb al-Nabawi we describe first as Damawi, or the sanguineous type, which is a type of individual who is predominantly hot, in other words, has a higher metabolism and a body type that retains more moisture. The Balghami, or phlegmatic, is described as the cold and moist temperament type, the melancholic as the cold and dry temperament, and the bilious as the hot and dry temperament. Now, all human beings can broadly be categorized under these four. And this is important to understand when determining who may be predisposed to specific illness conditions, including the overhyped COVID-19 so-called infection. Not everyone succumbs to it. Why is that so? Well, it's simply because not everyone has the same temperament or mizaj. The next important Tibb principle, which we'll focus on today in order to understand those hadith related to the prophetic guidance in the instance of contagion and quarantine, would be what is broadly called lifestyle factors. Now, TIP has a checklist consisting of six factors to consider when examining the relationship between you as an individual and your environment and your susceptibility to illness or your immunity to illness. Those six include the food and drink that we consume. That's the first. Depending on the type of food and drink you consume, you can actually, you could say, dispose the body to be either stronger and more immune to a pathogen, or by neglecting or not consuming the right types of foods given your body temperament, your body type, you could make yourself more susceptible to illness conditions. So food and drink is the first of those six factors that TIP considers. The second is the air and even the manner we breathe, the quality of the air and the manner in which we breathe. The third is exercise and movement. The fourth is sleep and rest cycles. The fifth is emotional states. Even a person's emotional state has a direct bearing on his health and also his susceptibility to illnesses or pathogens. And the last is the elimination of waste matter. So those are the six factors that all exert different effects that can either be of benefit or of detriment to us, given our body type. So let's briefly consider these factors in the context of contagion specifically, or at least some of these factors. The first thing to remember is that Muslims literally wrote the book on the science of contagion and infectious diseases. But all of this was strictly within the context of the deep principles that we've enumerated thus far, namely khalq or physis, mizaj, temperament, and these factors, six factors, that would determine a person's susceptibility or otherwise to illness conditions. So we'll use smallpox as a case in point, but the story begins with Muhammad bin Zakaria al-Razi. He was actually the first physician in all human history who in the 9th century described in detail the symptoms and the signs of smallpox and measles based on clinical examinations. Now, there are many books he has written, but the one book that is of interest to us contains actually 14 chapters on this subject alone. In the second chapter of this book, and we talked about this book last year, Al-Razi mentioned the bodies which are more susceptible, those temperaments, those type of human beings who are more susceptible to get smallpox. And even the times in the year, because remember, environment, the air, the weather, does impact on your state of health or susceptibility to illness. He also described the times in the year in which the disease is more common. So in this regard, he says that the bilious temperament, that person with a body type that is generally thin, his body core temperature is generally hotter, he's got a drier body, the body doesn't retain moisture, easily dehydrated. This type of thin, hot and dry body type is more susceptible to measles, but not to smallpox. Which means if you don't have this type of body, if you're a sanguineous person, for example, or phlegmatic, then you won't be susceptible to measles. He also describes how melancholic temperaments, those with a thin, cold and dry body type, are not susceptible to both diseases. In fact, they're quite immune to them. But if this body type is attacked by smallpox, then the disease will be benign. The times in which smallpox is most probable, according to Al-Razi, is primarily in severely hot and dry summers. And also in autumn, if it's a very hot and dry autumn without any rain, measles would be more expected in those type of susceptible individuals. In other words, a person with a bilious temperament, a hot and dry temperament. Which means that not all human beings are affected by the very same pathogen. The very same germ doesn't cause the illness, because if it did, everyone would succumb to it, but rather only a certain body type, namely those that have, you could say, a temperamental imbalance that creates bioenvironment that allows for this pathogen to manifest as an illness. So it's actually the body type which manifests this type of imbalance that causes for that illness, not the microbe, not the germ. Very interesting, he talks in his fourth chapter on the management of smallpox in general, and he indicates 10 procedures which should be carried out to achieve this purpose, which obviously I won't go through, it's just too much, but for doctors who are interested, I'll be happy to share this information. In his fifth chapter, which is actually the longest chapter of the book, he deals with the prevention of smallpox. And again, like TIB science always does in the context of optimizing health and guarding against ill health, his advice is to use special diets, modified, given your body type, to ensure that it is resistant to those microbes that may manifest as illness. Depending on the patient's condition, even age, you modify the diet to maintain balance, equilibrium, which therefore is experienced as health, failing which there will be ill health. You could say that the microbe, the germ, is an indicator of imbalance, not the cause of illness. There's also a whole gamut of medicines and procedures for treatment of the disease of smallpox and measles that he lists. And based on tip principles, he emphasizes the importance of diet, healthy lifestyle, hygiene also, to optimize the body's immunity in resisting naturally occurring opportunistic pathogens. Those who have balance, those who have what we call immunity, actually are not susceptible to germs or microbes. So the microbe doesn't cause illness. It's the imbalance within the body that allows for the pathogen to manifest as illness. Let us understand the difference, therefore, between germ theory, which is the mainstay of modern Western allopathic medicine, and physis, which is the foundation of Tibbin Nabawi, or this khalqi, inherent balance that Allah has asserted in all of creation. Now, another word I'm going to use, because it's relevant to the next stage of this discussion in understanding the hadith related to contagion and quarantine. Homeostasis. It refers to any self-regulating process by which biological systems maintain stability or balance while they adjust to conditions or environmental factors and ensures optimization of survival. Our bodies are underpinned by this self-regulating process. Western allopathic medicine assumes that illness is primarily caused by an invasive germ or pathogen, like we mentioned. In this context, there's an important name that we need to remember, Louis Pasteur. In the 1800s, he develops what is popularly now known as germ theory. Germ theory assumes that germs cause illness, and therefore it makes sense that killing germs would be the solution to both treating and preventing states of disease. Kill the germ and you achieve health. We say no. Health is balance, and it's determined by six factors. Diet, one of the most significant factors, a healthy lifestyle, including exercise, not the germ. The germ is not the cause of the illness. Rather, neglect that leads to imbalance leads to ultimately illness. Nevertheless, this germ theory takes hold in the Western medical assumption. At the same time, in France, while Pasteur was advocating the notion of germs as the cause of disease, there's another French scientist named Antoine Bichat, who we hear very little about, but was in fact the more significant player in the development of these theories and the understanding within the Western world of the nature of pathogens, microbes, viruses, bacteria, and its impact on the human body. Antoine Bichat advocates an opposing theory known as the cellular theory of diseases, or homeostasis, or what we've talked about up to this point, physis. Bicham's cellular theory is almost completely opposite to that of Pasteur's. Bicham noted that these germs that Pasteur was so terrified of were everywhere in nature and even existed inside the human being in a symbiotic relationship. He therefore says that the germ does not cause illness because it's already in your body. Rather, when the cellular integrity has been compromised, when the homeostasis is unsettled, when there's an imbalance within the human biosphere, that microbe, that germ which was already present, manifests as an illness. The cell becomes compromised, the germ therefore has an opportunity to invade and undermine cell health. So for example, we mentioned this last week, the average human being has about 30 trillion human cells that constitute his body. The bacteria cells in your body actually are 40 trillion. There are more bacteria cells than there are you. And as regards the virus cells that saturate your body, there are almost 400 trillion autonomous virus cells in your body, as you sit now, each and every one of us. So there are more bacteria and viruses in your body than there are human cells. And therefore, Bisham says, well, it certainly can't be the bacterium, it certainly can't be the virus, it certainly can't be the fungi that cause illness. There's something else at play. Because if that was the case, well, we would all be chronically ill continuously. Bisham noticed in his research that it was only when the tissue of the host became damaged or compromised, what they call cellular integrity is diminished, that these germs began to manifest as prevailing symptoms. Not the cause of the disease, but rather a symptom. So to prevent illness, Bisham advocated not the killing of the germs, but the cultivation of health. How? The re-establishment of balance. How? Well, he says diet, hygiene, healthy lifestyle practices, fresh air, exercise. The very same six factors that Tipin Nabawi, 1,400 years, codifies, well, Bisham comes along and says the same. The idea is that if the person has a strong immune system or internal balance and good tissue quality or terrain, as Bisham called it, the germs will not manifest in the person and they will have, well, good health. Ill health, imbalance, in other words, poor terrain. It's as simple as that. It is only when their health status starts to decline due to personal neglect, poor lifestyle choices, poor diet, a lack of hygienic practices, poor air quality, that they become victim to infections. So Bisham saw the infections, in fact, as a footnote to the state of illness. As the person restored his health through diet, as he modifies his health through adopting more hygienic personal practices, detoxification, the infection goes away on its own without needing any measure to kill the germ. Bastian Bicham had a long and often bitter rivalry over an extended period regarding who was right about the true cause of illness. Ultimately, Pasteur's ideas were promoted, and Bicham was completely censored, in fact, altogether forgotten. That's why you won't find Antoine Bicham's name in modern medical textbooks, particularly on germ theory, but rather you'll find Pasteur's. And the reason is quite simple. You can make more money out of germ theory. The practice of Western medicine is based on Pasteur's germ phobia, which gives rise to the use of vaccinations, antibiotics, and all sorts of other antimicrobials. Now, the irony is that towards the end of his life, the very same Pasteur who develops germ theory, upon which the entire edifice of modern Western allopathic medicine is based, the very same Pasteur renounces germ theory and admits that Bicham was right all along. In the 1920s, medical historians discovered also, ironically, that most of Pasteur's work, most of his theories, were plagiarized from Bicham's early research work. So here we find modern Western medicine based on a theory that was squarely disproven by his contemporary, namely Antoine Bicham, but Pasteur himself admitting that he was wrong ultimately, and also finding later that Pasteur's work was a plagiarization of Bicham's work, although warped to its own ends. In fact, Pasteur's last words were, "The microbe is nothing." He himself states it in his memoirs. "The terrain is everything." In other words, the human body and its state of equilibrium, balance, or otherwise, is everything. That is what determines health, not the germ. And this is what Tipin Nabawi has always firmly asserted. So the question is, how does germ theory come to prevail in Western medicine? Well, modern Western allopathic medicine, circus, has a very interesting story. It all actually starts with crude oil. No one would think that modern medicine starts with the petrochemical industry. The father of the oil age is a man called John D. Rockefeller. Born in 1839, he dies in 1937. He was an oil magnate. He was a robber baron. He was America's first billionaire, interestingly, and also a natural-born monopolist. By the turn of the 20th century, he controls 90% of all the oil refineries in the United States through his company called Standard Oil, which was later on broken up to become the famous Chevron, Exxon, Mobil, British Petroleum, or BP. So the names we have littered all of our streets today actually are born of this man, John D. Rockefeller, and most of us, I guess, were not even aware of it. At the same time, around 1900, 120 years ago, scientists discovered petrochemicals, and more so the ability to create all kinds of subsidiary compounds or chemicals from oil. For example, the first plastic called Bakelite was made from oil in 1907. Scientists were also discovering other interesting things about oil. They discovered that various vitamins could also be extracted. And they guessed that many pharmaceutical drugs could similarly be made from oil. And this was a wonderful opportunity, Rockefeller being the natural monopolist and opportunist, saw the ability to monopolize the oil, the chemical, and the medical industries all at the same time. So for Rockefeller, the most attractive feature of petrochemicals was that everything could be patented and thereafter sold for exorbitant profits. Now, but there was one problem with Rockefeller's plan for the medical industry, and that is that natural, or what we could call herbal medicines, were more popular in America at that time. In fact, most of the doctors and medical colleges in the United States 120 years ago were practicing exclusively holistic medicine, using knowledge born of the Islamic medical tip tradition, and more notably the works of Ibn Sina, the famous Avicenna. And also, even Native American medicine. And this was the mainstay of medical practice in the United States, which was technologically one of the most, if not the most, advanced state on earth. Natural and herbal medicines were the mainstay of American medical practice. Now, I'll make a quick side comment at this stage, and I think it's important, given that American medicine 120 years ago, before the rise of petrochemicals and the pharmaceutical industry, all born of the opportunism of Rockefeller, were based also on Native American medicine. If you look at Native Indigenous Noongar Bush medicine right here in Western Australia, how is it that not a single Muslim doctor has ever considered studying traditional Indigenous Aboriginal medicine, while thousands of books and research articles have been written by Australian non-Muslim specialists in the field? Not one single Muslim doctor has ever considered Noongar Bush medicine, for example. Is it because of a deep-seated sense of obsequious inferiority and self-loathing vis-a-vis the white man, believing that only what Europe accomplishes or what the white man says and does is of note? What the black man says is primitive. It's irrelevant. What the Aboriginal tells me is stupid. Is that probably the reason why Muslim doctors haven't even ventured exploring the tremendous medical potential in Western Australian Noongar Bush medicine? Is there racism in medicine, which we certainly know there is, but is there racism also at the very heart and core of the average Muslim physician? Or such a deep sense of inferiority and self-loathing? Not only has he cast aside Tibbin Nabawi and a glorious Islamic medical practice that spans 1,400 years, but also he won't dare go to the black man, especially not the Aboriginal industry, to ask him for medical advice. Well, here's a fun fact. There's a thing called Gumbi Gumbi. It's a small shrub that's found throughout the drier areas of Australia. It's perhaps the most potent yet versatile indigenous medicine. It's used in the effective treatment of numerous coronavirus infections, including chronic colds, chronic flus, and recent scientific research into the benefits of Gumbi Gumbi find it to boast an array of benefits, including being not just an antipruritic, in other words, it's effective in treating eczema, but it's also an antiviral, it's a detoxifier, probably one of the most potent detoxifiers, it's a blood pressure regulator, it's an immune system booster, as well as it's proven to be effective in treating various cancers, digestive disorders, chronic fatigue, and even mental illness. So the question is, why is this medicinal plant not being considered by our Muslim doctors as an alternative to the toxic COVID-19 mRNA gene-disrupted disguised as a vaccine? Well, I'm a Maulana. I'm a religious man having to teach this medical information to so-called professionals in a Friday khutbah, which is really tragic. That's not my work. I've got other business. But how is it that Muslim doctors haven't actually explored these far more efficacious alternatives? Free alternatives. Alternatives that actually have no atrocious side effects, as we've recently discovered with these mRNA gene disruptors. Why is it that non-Muslim specialists actually have more enthusiasm, while Muslim medical practitioners seem not to be the least interested in traditional Noongar Bush medicine? Is there some type of inherent racism? Well, that's just a little side note. Let's get back to our story of Big Pharma and leave the Muslim medical fraternity with their own conscience. Rockefeller, the monopolist, had to figure out a way to get rid of his biggest competition. So he used the classic strategy of problem, reaction, solution. In other words, to create a problem and then scare people and then offer a pre-planned solution. So he goes to his buddy called Andrew Carnegie. Probably most of you have heard about the Carnegie Foundation, very famous think tank in the US. He's another plutocrat. He makes his money from monopolizing the steel industry. And they devise a scheme. From that prestigious Carnegie Foundation, they send a man named Abraham Flexner to travel around the United States and report on the status of medical colleges and hospitals. And this leads to the famous Flexner Report. Google it, the Flexner Report, which gives birth to modern medicine as we know it. Why? Because the Flexner Report says that the need for revamping and centralizing medical institutions in the United States is imperative. And based on this report, more than half of all medical colleges are closed. Natural medicines, which was the mainstay of American medical practice 100 years ago, homeopathy and all similar normative medical practices were mocked, demonized. In fact, doctors were even jailed because of the Flexner Report. To help with the transition and to change the minds of other doctors and scientists, Rockefeller then gives more than 100 million, this is 120 years ago, he gives more than 100 million to colleges and hospitals, and he founds a philanthropic front called the General Education Board. Now this is that classic carrot and stick approach, because the General Education Board then goes on to homogenize medicine in the US and institute petrochemicals and pharmaceuticals as the mainstay of modern medicine. So in a very short time, medical colleges are all streamlined, they all homogenize, all the students are learning the same thing, and medicine is all about using patented drugs, and those drugs actually come from where? The oil industry, which is monopolized by who? John D. Rockefeller. Scientists also receive huge grants by Rockefeller to study how plants cure diseases, but the goal is first to identify the chemicals in the plants which were effective in treating that specific illness condition, and then to recreate a similar chemical, but not identical, in the lab that could be patented. Synthetic drugs, which is the mainstay again of modern allopathic medicine. It is all synthetic and it is all patented. So now we are 100 years later, churning out doctors who know nothing about the normative medical practice up to 100 years ago. They know nothing about holistic practices when it comes to optimizing health. We have an entire society that is enslaved to corporations for its own health. America and, in fact, Australia and the world spends trillions on healthcare. It should rather be called sick care, because the intention is not to optimize health, but rather to manage illness. And it's focused not on cure. It addresses only symptoms. Therefore, it creates repeat customers. There's no cure for cancer. There's no cure for diabetes. There's no cure for autism. There's no cure for asthma. There's no cure even for the common flu. And its glorified version, COVID-19. In fact, the so-called COVID-19 vaccine doesn't prevent contraction of the virus. And this is admitted by our own medical fraternity. It doesn't prevent the transmission of the virus. All it does is supposedly mitigates the symptoms, which also is quite incorrect, because if you look at the alarming reports from across the world, even Australia, especially Israel, we find that that's actually not true. But that's another subject. That's not the purpose of our bayan. So, the question is, why would there be a desire for real cures? Modern allopathic medicine is a system founded by oligarchs and plutocrats. That's really the beginnings of modern Western medicine. It's not born of physicians like the great Ibn Sina or Galen or Hippocrates. Modern doctors are no more than prostitutes to the pharmaceutical industry, which after the banking industry is actually the second largest profit spinner in the world. It's larger than the arms industry. The pharmaceutical industry has the largest lobby in Capitol Hill in Washington after the banking industry. So, having said this, we now, I think, have sufficient background knowledge to responsibly discuss the hadith related to contagion and quarantine, and to dispel the seeming contradictions in those important narrations, given that so many Muslim physicians across the world have cherry-picked their way through the hadith to justify their preconceived medical prejudices and their theory choices. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.